Welcome to the Liberty Beacon Special, and I am your host, Roger Landry, founder of the Liberty Beacon Project. And as everybody knows, this is a special. We do not do this show weekly. We do not do this show on any schedule whatsoever. This show is done when we have a guest with a pertinent, a very pertinent or germane topic that needs to be discussed and never held to a schedule. Today, I'm going to introduce my co-host. And this is Ariana Love, an American living in Finland, our TLB representative and contributor, senior admin of the soon-to-be-launched TLB website, The Middle East Rising, and host of a radio talk show by the same name on the Liberty Beacon Radio Network. Rarely have I seen an individual with the energy and passion for the well-being of all of humanity this lady displays daily. Oh, yeah. And she has a great smile, too. Welcome, Ariana.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Roger.
All right. You have some information on our guest. Would you please make us aware of this?
Yes. Miko Pilid is with us today. He has dedicated his life to tearing down the Israeli separation wall and transforming the apartheid system that exists today into a secular democracy where Israelis and Palestinians will live as equal citizens. Miko has written a book called The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And Miko, it's an honor to have you here with us today. You're an inspiration to a great many people, including myself. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
All right. Well, let's start this ball rolling. And as everybody knows, we don't do interviews here. We do discussions. And these discussions are always led by our guests because these are the people we feel had that very important message that need to be gotten out. So you basically, Miko, you have had a mission for a very long time. Let's start out by making the audience aware of exactly what that mission is in your own words, my friend.
Well, again, thank you for the interview and for this opportunity. I think the mission, if you will, is to get the story out. Or maybe I guess the mission has got more than one objective. But the first objective is certainly to get the story out. And over the years, it's been made clear to me that there's a story that I should tell. And that led to me to eventually writing the book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And that story is a story of that's reflected in my family's history, which is a story of the Zionist colonization of Palestine. And then the story of a boy who was born into that, which is me, being brought up with all the stories and the mythology and the heroism, this entire very wonderful, very romantic Zionist narrative. So being born into it and being wrapped, having it wrapped around you your entire life. And then at some point, taking a look outside of that narrative and taking a look outside of that story and realizing that, or gradually realizing that the entire story is a myth. And that the story completely ignores the history and the landscape and the people who live in this country, in that country, which I was born and taught and educated to believe it was the land of Israel, but is in fact Palestine. And the people who live there and to whom this land belongs and from whom this land was taken and to whom a great injustice was done, which were the Palestinians. So coming up, growing up as a general's son and then venturing onto this journey into Palestine as an Israeli. And then there's no end to the story because the journey continues, but the conclusion at the end, or at least the first conclusion at the end, is that there's a reality today in which we have two nations, this new creation called Israelis, which are the Jews and the Jews who came to colonize Palestine and their descendants like myself, and the Palestinians, who are now both a part of the landscape of this country of Palestine, and need to find a way to live in peace and move on beyond the strife and the conflict, and what is the best way to do that. The second part of the mission is to realize that what we need to do is we need to act, and we need to get more and more people to understand that this conflict is not some intractable conflict, is not some unsolvable old biblical conflict that goes back, you know, who knows how many millennia, but is something that was caused as a result of the import of racism and colonialism from white Christian Europe. It is something that is solvable. We've seen similar things being solved, you know, in our lifetime, and there's no reason to assume that Israelis and Palestinians can't put this together, but there's an idea that has to be pushed forward and has to be made clear. And that idea is that these two people can live in peace, but the regime has to change. There can no longer be this colonialist, racist, Zionist regime that governs the entire country, but there has to be a government and a state that represents all the people who live there, which some people say is radical, but really when you think about it, it's probably the most mainstream, unradical idea that's out there, which is equal rights and respecting people's civil rights and dignity and so on. So those are the two parts of the mission. One is to get the story out of the transformation, because I think that applies to other nations, other people, other narratives. And the second part is that we need to work to get this thing done. We need to line up behind the banner of a single democracy over Palestine, and that when we say free Palestine, we mean free all of Palestine, not two or three little cities that Israel deems worthy of some autonomy.
I not only agree with you, but I see the parallels. As you say, this is something that's not only taking place in Israel. I grew up in a country that was totally different. I was born three generations ago. Today, what we see is a lot of our rights have disappeared in America. Today, what we see is that our civil liberties are being encroached upon. So being someone who has woken up to the fact that things are not as we are told, the stories of America have changed. The reality of America has changed. And I see that in what you're saying about Israel. But I do see that there is something waking up in the world to the Palestinian and Israeli. Basically, it's a conflict. And what I see is, the last thing I saw was 500 rabbis from across the globe rising up and saying that there needs to be an end put to the genocide being perpetrated against the Palestinians.
Yes, I think you're right. I mean, everybody that's involved in this issue sees that there is light at the end of the tunnel. And this is, I think, something that's being said for the first time in a very long time. I was asked yesterday at an event here in San Diego, at San Diego State University. I spoke about the need to support BDS and the divestment campaign on campus there, which is something that they're working on right now. And somebody asked me at the end of my remarks, how can anybody be optimistic at this point on this issue? And the reality is that if you try to tell the story or try to describe the life of a life in a day of a Palestinian over just a 24-hour day in the life of a Palestinian to anybody else, anybody here in America, somebody on the street, they couldn't possibly believe you because it is so horrifying. And it's not just horrifying because bombs are falling and people are being massacred. That's not the worst of it. The worst of it is the bureaucracy. It's the day-to-day hardships that are being imposed on Palestinians by Israel and by the reality that exists there. So there's really no cause for optimism if you look at it that way, then there's really no point and no cause for optimism. But like you say, if we look at the things that are happening around the world, if we look at the strength of the Palestinian solidarity movement in Europe, if we look at the growth of the divestment movement on campuses here in America, the growth of the Students for Justice in Palestine and other groups that are supporting the Palestinian cause. If we look at the changes in some of the churches in America, and granted, these are the more progressive churches, but still, these are churches that now, instead of going to the Holy Land to look at relics, they go to the Holy Land to support the Palestinians. And when we look at the change, just the number of American Jews who participate in the Palestinian solidarity movement here in America, not to mention, again, in other countries, and the strength of the Palestinian resistance, the Palestinian popular resistance in Palestine, and their dedication and their principled, well, their dedication to principled resistance, nonviolent resistance. When we look at all of these and we take maybe a 10-year look, in other words, 10 years into the future, that's where we see cause for optimism. So that's, there is a big change taking place. I think it's a tidal wave, and I think it's going to grow and grow and get stronger and stronger. And just like this happened in the past, people are going to scratch their head one day and say, wow, this happened. We had no idea this was going to happen. You know, it's like the fall of the Soviet Union. Suddenly somebody said, people started saying, how did we not foresee this? You know, or the fall of apartheid in South Africa. In the late 80s, most people still didn't believe apartheid would fall. By 1994, Mandela was president. So people scratch their heads and say, oh, we had no idea this was going to happen. But I think in this case, we can already see the signs.
Yes. You know,
and in fact, so it's there is cause for optimism, and this is why.
Well, you know, you use the word optimism a lot, and for all out there listening, if you don't have optimism, if you go at anything or look at anything with a defeatist attitude, it is your attitude that will influence your actions. There is reason for optimism, as you say, Miko, and it is becoming more readily apparent. It is coming out into the light of day, and I am seeing it, and we report on these issues within the Liberty Beacon Project, but rarely do we get a chance to talk to somebody who is so embedded in this story as you are. So if you could continue with that, unless, of course, Ariana, you've had something you'd like to say to Miko.
No, I'm ready to hear what Miko has to say.
So
also,
let's take your story from ground zero, all right, my friend, and tell us exactly what brought you into this, what caused your awakening, and what you feel needs to be accomplished. Let's get a message out to the people listening that's your message, not something that someone else says, not something that is written about what you said, not something secondhand.
Well, if I do that, then there'd be no reason for people to buy the book.
Well, you've only got 40 more minutes, and I don't think you could cite the entire book in 40 minutes. But
no, I probably couldn't.
You might
no.
be able to synopsize it.
Yeah. I mean, I was born into this. It's not something that I had to get myself into. I was born into this. I was born into a reality where, or into a family, I should say, where every piece of the Zionist story and the story of Israel was within this family. I mean, there were stories about, part of the family came from the background, like, you know, like Tevye in the Fiddler on the Roof, which probably everybody in the world is familiar with. Poor Jews who were, you know, who lived in a small shtetl and so forth. And I had another set of grandparents who were these Jewish intellectuals and educated people, and all of whom were Zionists for different reasons and ended up in Palestine. And then we have the story of my father, who was a young officer in 1948 and fought heroically in the War of Independence and so forth. And all the drama that came along with that. And then he remained in the Israeli army and he was a general during the 1967 war, which again is one of those very dramatic moments, or at least dramatized moments in the history of Zionism and the State of Israel. Then we have the story of the beginnings of the Zionist-Palestinian dialogue, if you will, which is something my father initiated in the mid-70s, where Zionists like him, who were moderate Zionists, began a dialogue with major figures within the PLO to talk about what we know today as the two-state solution, trying to convince the PLO to change its ways and accept the state of Israel in return for a Palestinian state, which of course turned out to be a disaster. The Palestinians were convinced, the PLO was convinced, and we know that that was a big mistake, but that was the beginning of that. And then we have, sadly, we have the story of the bereavement with the killing of my sister Nurit's daughter, Smadar, who was killed when she was 12 years old in a suicide attack that was ordered and executed by Hamas in Jerusalem in 1997. And then the transformation that I went through, my sister went through, my brother-in-law, many other members of my family went through, where we began to take a closer look at the question of Palestine, at what Zionism is all about and what the state of Israel is about. And we all reached not the same conclusions, but we're all working on very similar paths to try to bring about change. So I was born into this. And then probably the last aspect of this particular narrative that I just relayed is me returning to San Diego after my niece's funeral and meeting Palestinians for the first time, and that was here in San Diego. And, you know, the chapter in the book that talks about the beginning of my journey into Palestine begins with a line, "My journey into Palestine began in San Diego. I was 39 years old." Because this was the first time I joined a what was called a Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group. And this was the first time I'd ever met Palestinians, the first time I ever sat with the Palestinians in their home. And this
amazing
exchange began, and me hearing all these stories. I mean, it was dialogue, so it was very friendly. It was kind of a very comfortable environment.
I have a question for you, Miko, that pertains to what you just said. I know how big Israel is, and Israel is smaller than the state of New Jersey. To say that in San Diego you met or actually had dialogue for the first time with Palestinians, how is that possible in a country that small? Was it really that segregated a society?
Oh, absolutely. Israel is Israel is a completely segregated society. I mean, you have Israeli neighborhoods, a few hundred yards away from a Palestinian neighborhood, and nobody ever talks, meets. There's not even a common language quite often. The segregation of the state of Israel was one of its major pillars of Zionism. One of the major pillars upon which the state of Israel was established was the idea of segregation and separation. It's called Hafradah. It was coined in the 30s. This idea of apartheid, of separation between Jews and non-Jews, and creating institutions for Jews, creating Jewish labor, creating Jewish newspaper, creating everything Jewish and non-Jewish, and focusing, of course, on developing the Jewish and denying whoever is not Jewish everything and anything, including the rights to the very land that the Zionists took from the Palestinians. So the segregation still is very successful. It's one of the, I think, the biggest successes of Zionism is to be able to create such segregation, such very clear and absolute separation between what they call Jews and non-Jews in such a small country. Absolutely. And to be able to maintain such a powerful narrative, which is diametrically opposed to what actually took place. The Zionist narrative is 180 degrees different from what the Palestinian story is. And of course, we know now that this narrative that the Palestinians have been talking about for decades has been verified and validated by Israeli historians, you know, great historians like Ilan Pappe, others who were looking into this and said, wait a minute, what the Palestinians have been saying all these years is not only true, but there's a lot more to it that even they haven't told us yet. But this is one of the big successes, and this was my first exposure to the story of what took place in 1948, the Palestinian catastrophe, the Nakba, to the story of massacres, and again, an environment where people are just telling their story and the story of their families, And it was not only shocking, but it was physically very, very painful to hear that this is something that took place. And it wasn't this wonderfully heroic narrative that I was upon which I was raised. So that's the gist of the story from the ground up, really. I will say that living in America all these years now, I mean, I've been back to Palestine. Now I'm, you know, the next step was to go to Palestine and learn about Palestine and travel into Palestine, in other words, away from Israel and into Palestine, into Palestinian areas and neighborhoods and so forth. And I've been doing that for a very long time now. But living here in America, what's interesting is that how strong the Zionist narrative is here. Which is really quite amazing.
Well, if
that was something I wanted to ask you, actually, you know, that the truth about Palestine and this lie you talk about, you grow up with a Zionist lie, and it seems that the whole world seems to be brainwashed with this lie, and you know it seems to be so shocking. People talk about when they become aware of the injustice of the Palestinian people, it's like an awakening point. They awaken. This is how they describe it. Oh, I woke up at such and such time, and here's how. And they have a story about that. How do you think that the Zionist state has been so successful in shielding what they're doing in the world?
Well, they're very smart. My grandfather, I have a poster that advertises a lecture my grandfather gave in 1920. I forget in which city. It's in Russian. I mean, the whole poster is in Russian. Only the date. It says, you know, March of 1920. And he is there. You know, Dr. Avram Katznelson and so on is here will be there to speak about the situation in the land of Israel, Be'eretz Israel. You know. So this idea of lobbying, of having very smart, highly educated, very clean looking, you know, none of them looked like Jews. That whole generation of young Zionists didn't look like Jews. They were shaved, they wore suits, and they drank tea, and they, you know, they spoke five languages. And so when they traveled around the world to speak to the civilized world, you know, they were accepted because they looked the part, and they knew how to do this. And when you think about it, it's been 100 years almost of lobbying and creating organizations, and when you have that many years of lobbying, you manage to influence everybody: the education system, the financial system, the media, politics. You know, they've been relentless the last 100 years in promoting Zionism and everything that comes with Zionism, part of which is Islamophobia and the persecution of Arabs in America that we see today is a part of that. Because if you support Zionism, then of course you have to realize how evil the Arabs are and how evil and dangerous the Muslims are. It goes hand in hand. But they've been very successful because they've been doing it for a very long time, and they've had very smart people who were working on this, and they managed to gain money, and they managed to learn how to do this very, very well.
Well, I need to say that very, very well is probably an understatement. I know growing up, I have seen a lot of presidents come and go, and I know that every single one of them who has had it within their goal to become president of the United States have pretty much had to go to Israel, had their picture taken at the Wailing Wall, and basically this was to show absolute support for the state of Israel. And
Roger, you don't have to go as far as the president. Every city council member of a small city in America has to do this.
Well, what we also know is that one of the most, if not the most powerful lobby in this country is AIPAC.
Yeah.
So the influence of the Zionist Israeli state, for a state which is one of the smallest states on the planet, has one of the largest global influences of any nation in history. Would you agree with that?
Well, I'm not a historian, so I can't make those comparisons, but it's certainly very powerful, and it certainly is known to be one of the strongest lobbies and most influential lobbies in America. And it's true everywhere. It's not only true in America. It's true in Europe, too.
Agreed.
Which is why, for example, what you see in Europe, you see a huge gap, a huge difference between public opinion and government policies towards Israel and Palestine. The solidarity movement in Europe is very strong, yet European governments are all in bed with Israel. And there's a big gap there, and that's because
that's a crowded
they know how
bed.
They it's yeah, and it's a very crowded bed. Yeah, maybe they take turns, but they all support Israel, and you know, speaking about you know the BDS boycotting and so forth is very unpopular in European countries, and this is why they've been very very good. And I think it's really important to connect the dots here. I think one of the things that the Zionists the entire PR system that the State of Israel has is they're very good at isolating issues. So for example, there's the issue of Islamic fundamentalism, which is of course you know all these jihadists that are out to kill all of us. You've got Gaza, which is again it's completely isolated from anything else, and you've got Hamas, which is isolated. You have problems of the Islamic movement in I don't know where, Hamas in other parts of Palestine maybe. Everything is completely isolated. There's no context to anything. Nobody ever talks about the fact that there would not have been a Gaza Strip had there not been ethnic cleansing in 1948, because the Gaza Strip was created in order to house all the thousands of refugees who were just thrown out of their homes. You know, nothing is ever put in context. I think beyond that, we need to realize that there's a larger context. Again, Islamophobia here in America, the hatred and the persecution of Arabs, the brutal execution of three young Arab Muslims in Chapel Hill, detaining and arresting Muslims and Palestinians in horrific conditions in jails here in America. The Holy Land Foundation is one such case where five Palestinian Muslims are now in jail for decades. I just got an email from one of them because he was penalized in the prison, and he describes the violation. The violation is a description of a group of Muslims praying. In other words, group prayer is they're denied the right for group prayer, and because they did pray, and again, the violation describes exactly the movements that Muslims, you know, go through when they pray, and for that they were penalized. Can you imagine if 10 Jews anywhere in America, whether it's in a prison, an army camp, in the street, wanted to pray together and would be denied, not only denied but penalized for trying for praying? You know, and everything is tied to this one thing. And I think it's very important to put it into context, because the most important aspect of the Zionist propaganda, of the Israeli PR machine, is maintaining the narrative. We cannot have any holes in the narrative. If Muslims are good, that means they might be the Palestinian cause might be true. If Arabs are good, then that means the Palestinian narrative, again, might be true. If there's a Muslim or an Arab charity that is helping Palestinians, that's poking holes in the narrative, because if you know, we shouldn't be helping Palestinians because Palestinians are terrorists. You know, this whole thing is built in order to protect the most important treasure that they have, and that is the narrative, because they've been so successful in indoctrinating the West with the Zionist narrative. And if you look at, you know, when my kids went through school, I looked at their textbooks, you know, AP History, for example, you know, the entire chapter about, you know, which is a college course that they teach in high school, the entire portion of the ancient Hebrews and so forth is all biblical. It's all from the Bible. They're not a single shred of history in this AP World History course. You know, they might as well be teaching creationism as well in that course. And this is the power of this, and again, they do this by using money to help communities, by, you know, they do many positive things, but they always insert the need to support their narrative and to demonize Arabs and Muslims and Palestinians. This is all part of the same package, and I think if you start connecting the dots, we see exactly how this is all coming from the same source. This thing about Netanyahu coming now and trying to foment all this all these, you know, the issue of Iran all the time. Everybody knows there's no threat by Iran. Everybody knows Israel is never going to attack Iran. Iran's never going to attack anybody else. They never have. But here we are. Everybody's talking about Iran when Netanyahu comes, because that has to be the issue. Otherwise, they're going to be talking about other things. So I think it's important, again, to connect the dots and see how this is all working.
Well, again, you bring up such sterling points. And what I need people to understand who are listening to this is not an anti-Israel show. I need to tell you that the Liberty Beacon Project is not anti-Israel. There are a lot of really good, well-meaning people living in Israel. It's just like America. America today is seen as the bully on the block. And the people around the world who have a negative image of the United States love the American people. They're not anti-American. They're anti, what is America doing to the world? Well, this is the same narrative that translates straight to Israel. We are not trying to tell anybody here not to like Israel, to hate Israel, or to have ill feelings towards the citizens of Israel. What we are trying to bring to light here today is the injustice being perpetrated by the ingrained system in Israel against the people who really don't have the technology, the weapons, or even the numbers to push back. They are in an untenable position. Am I hitting this pretty close to a bullseye, Miko?
I think I'm pretty clear about my anti-Israel stance. I don't want there to be any doubts.
I don't hate the Israeli people.
I don't hate anybody. Yes. Hate is not the issue, and the people are not the issue. But I will say this: the Israeli government is voted in by the Israeli people. Israel is a democracy. You know, you can't blame Arabs for their leaders, because nobody ever elected them. They were mostly appointed by this, you know, by the U.S. and paid for by the U.S. and armed by the U.S. And so they do what they're told. And part of what they're told to do is to oppress their people. Israel is not like that. Israelis vote in large numbers. The Israeli government, the Israeli Knesset, represents the will of the people.
Wow.
It's a very different reality. Israelis can go in the streets today and protest and demand that the brutal siege on Gaza, this inexcusable, unjustifiable cruelty, be lifted immediately. Nobody will be shot. Nobody will be killed. Nobody will be arrested. I mean, you might be arrested if you protest too hardly, but you know, just for a few hours. You know, there is no danger for Israelis to speak up, yet they don't. Israelis can be out in the streets protesting and demanding the Palestinians get the same share of water Israelis do. Palestinians, who make up more than half of the population, get only about 3% of the water allocated to them, not to mention land and other rights and other issues. Israelis say nothing. During the last attack, this murder in cold blood that took place in Gaza this summer for 51 days, the Israeli government numbers, the Israeli government was on a high. They've never had such wonderful popularity. They've never had such great ratings. So it's hard to speak about this and not have strong feelings and strong criticism to Israel and to Israeli society, because it is a democratic society for Israeli Jews, and they do vote and they do have an influence, yet they use it not in a positive way, but in a way that is harmful and cruel.
A way that perpetuates the system. Again, we see the exact same thing happening in this country. We, in the 1960s, railed by the millions against our we were in one war, the Vietnam War, an illegal war. And by the millions, we came out and protested. Today, the United States, in one fashion or another, is involved in at least a half a dozen nations around the world propagating some sort of hostilities. And where have all the peaceniks gone? Are they all dead? You don't hear a word about it. So, again, I do see a parallel. So it is easier to understand it when you put things in that context, Miko.
I wanted to interject here. There was a poll, a study done in the Israeli society. They were asked who believed that there was excessive force used in Gaza, and 95% of the Israelis believed that there was no excessive force used in Gaza, and this was just astonishing to me. the mindset of the Israeli society. It's just mind-blowing. There was about 2% who were believed that there was excessive force used, and then about 3% were unsure.
It gets worse. I was there this last summer during almost the entire time that the attack on Gaza was taking place. And, you know, life on the Israeli side was really not disrupted. I mean, there was a siren from time to time and everybody got all excited about that. But, I mean, people, the coffee shops were full, restaurants were full. The highways were, cars, people were driving. So, I mean, life for Israelis was not disrupted while they were massacring thousands of Palestinians, you know, just really a half-hour drive from Jerusalem. And some Israeli cities are only 10 minutes away from Gaza. I mean, it's not far, you know.
So basically, they could hear the bombs going off. They could hear.
There's this hill overlooking Gaza where there's a little sofa. Somebody put a sofa and a few chairs, and people would go there to take a look and view. But the narrative, the conversation that was taking place was either that the army was doing a good job or that the army was not doing enough, that they're still treating Hamas with kid gloves and they need to take off the kid gloves. Now, they brought in, I don't know, I think when the ground invasion began, they had something like, they called up, if I'm not mistaken, 40,000 reservists. You'd think they were preparing for World War III or something. I mean, considering there's never been a tank or a warplane or any serious artillery or anything like that ever in Gaza. I mean, there's never been a Palestinian army. This is a level of insanity that's hard to believe. And I took the car down, you know, along the border with Gaza, and you see these fields. And from a distance, it looked like they were all green. And when you got closer, you saw that they were green with tanks. Mm. The number of tanks was way beyond what the eye can see. I mean, way into the horizon. And this is after the aerial assault, where I don't know how many thousands of tons of bombs were dropped. On Gaza. So. So it's well known that Israelis were all for this. And again, if there was any criticism of the government at that time, it was that they weren't killing enough.
Wow. And there were three Israeli civilians that died, right? As compared to the...
Yeah, I believe there were, I actually saw this yesterday, these numbers. There were 66... soldiers that died, and those pretty heavy casualties, considering again the and a lot of them were officers, which is interesting. But that's what you get when you get a big army stuck in a small place. You're going to get more casualties. And there were a few civilians, maybe three or four, I forget the exact number, but there were a few civilian casualties. And then, of course, the vast majority of the casualties were soldiers and officers. And some 2,300 Palestinians were murdered, and actually we don't know the count yet, because as a result of the bombing and as a result of this hell that the Palestinians were put through, for example, there were a lot of premature births. Now there is no postnatal care in Gaza, so a lot of these babies are going to die, and they're still dying. We don't know yet how many people were found under the rubble. We don't know how many people are going to be freezing to death now because it's very cold, and they can't rebuild.
How many ambulances and how many fire trucks were attacked by Israeli forces going out trying to save lives? That is what really caught my eye.
Yeah.
Not that the rest of it wasn't horrible. When you figure that a state can be responsible for several thousand deaths and sweep it away as a necessity, but a few, in comparison, Israelis die, and it is the evil of fanaticism. So the narrative on both sides is just absolutely appalling.
Well, one of the narrative from Israel that I hear all the time is they skirt any blame onto Hamas. And just to give a realistic perspective, I was researching this recently. Only three Israeli citizens actually were killed this summer, and in 2012, the last Israeli assault on Gaza, only three Israeli civilians were killed, compared to almost hundreds and hundreds of Palestinians. And you know, then the time before that in 2009, same thing, three Israeli civilians. So this is a recurring number that, you know, it's a curious thing why it's always three, three, and three. But anyway, it gives a perspective, you know.
Well, it not only gives a perspective in my eye, but it blatantly states that the value of a Palestinian life is held far below the value of an Israeli citizen's life. And could you speak to that a little bit, Miko?
That's exactly what it is. That's exactly how it is. There are bumper stickers. In fact, I took a picture of one when I was just there, because I was there for just a short while in December. And the bumper sticker reads something like, you know, the life of Israeli soldiers is more valuable than the life of Palestinian civilians, of Arab civilians, or something like that, something along those lines. This is absolutely true. This is exactly how people see it. That's exactly how they see it and how they view it. Here we go. I have this here. The life of our soldiers come before the lives of our civilians of our enemy. As though this is to, I don't know, justify something or other. Yeah, this is true. The life of Palestinians has no value at all. No value at all. There is no such thing as a value or rights or anything like that when it comes to Palestinians. Israel is a completely, completely racist state and a completely, completely racist society.
Isn't it also true that just recently 177 Palestinians were evicted from their homes, which were bulldozed? How can you say Gaza is for you, the West Bank is for you, this is for you, and then when Israel feels that there is something there they wish to have, they go in and compact the small area that these Palestinians have to live in today. I've heard stated on several occasions in several publications that Gaza is, in fact, the largest refugee camp in the world, and that basically what you have is a large population trapped in a small area with no place to go. Yet the bulldozers come in on a regular basis, and they mow down Palestinian homes and take what they feel is valuable to Israel.
Yeah, what Israel says and what Israel does are completely, they're two different things. What Israel says are things that they can sell. These are sound bites. You can see, and certain sound bites are catchier and they work, so they repeat them. Certain sound bites are, you know, they're not, don't work as well, and so they do away with them. That's how they work. Now, what Israel does is follow a very, very clear strategy of ethnic cleansing and destruction of anything that's not Jewish in Palestine. So you have two different things working here. You know, one has got to do with PR, and one has to do with the mission. So, you know, people, it's funny, I hear that a lot. People say, you know, they say they want peace, but then when the Palestinians or the Arabs come up with a peace plan, they don't. You know, and then they talk about, you know, how dare they, you know, build more settlements and take more land, you know, blah, 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 near Hebron or near Bethlehem or near wherever the case may be. I'm going, what do you mean, how dare they? This is what they've been doing for 70 years. They still do this with Palestinian towns that are what's called within Israel, or the 1948 Palestine. They take away Palestinian land from Palestinians from within 1948 all the time. Mm. Land confiscation never ends. Building for Jews only on Palestinian land is what Israel is all about. That's what Israel's been doing since 1948. It hasn't changed. It's not going to change. You think they care if it's in Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, West Jerusalem? It's all the land of Israel. It all belongs to the Jews, and nobody else matters. That's why it's so important to make it absolutely clear that the Zionist regime has to end in Palestine, that the name of the game has to be creating a real democracy without the Zionist regime, dismantling this military monster, and dismantling this racist apartheid regime in favor of a democracy where everybody gets a vote. And this will be better. That's why they need to understand the possibility of Israelis and Palestinians living in peace is real. The possibility of Israel living in peace with the Palestinians is science fiction. Mm-hmm. Israel has no interest in living in peace. It's impossible for it to live in peace. It's a monster that can only consume. It has an insatiable appetite and can only consume. And the only light at the end of the tunnel is that it is such a brainless monster that it's going to destroy itself. And I believe it's already destroying itself. It's self-destructing. But that is the reality. And that's why it's so important to stop talking about a solution that includes Israel. Any solution that's talked about has to be a solution that in which there Israel has been transformed into whatever it is it's going to be called, but it's a state of the people who live there, who are Palestinians and Israelis and Palestinians. This is exactly why, because all these expectations and all these surprises that Israel does this and Israel does that, of course Israel arrests children, of course Israel tortures prisoners, of course Israel has no respect for human life of Palestinians, but it never had. This is not new. Israel was established after a massive act of terrorism and ethnic cleansing in 1948. How different is it from today? It's the exact same process, just different people.
Well, I guess that could go back to, if something works, why change it? But I'd like to shift the conversation just a little bit if you feel comfortable discussing this. I know of Americans across this country who support the Palestinians. The Liberty Beacon Project is personally associated with quite a few of the groups on social media and other things. And we see the blowback against American citizens who speak out against the Palestinian plight. Now, you are the son of an Israeli general. This must influence your life quite a bit. You must have seen some blowback. You must have seen some pushback, some attempts to quiet you, to silence you. Can you discuss that a little bit for us, please?
Yeah, I actually haven't seen much. I've seen very little. They very rarely come to my lectures to do anything. From time to time, there's somebody who comes in and asks a question or something. But it's very rare that I get any kind of pushback or any kind of attempts to, you know, from time to time, organizers of a lecture will let me know that somebody sent an angry letter or somebody's trying to defund or reschedule or stuff like that. The only times that I've had a few times where they did show up. I've had one time, really. I was supposed to be in Mexico City this week, actually, or rather next week. I had three events scheduled there and they were all canceled because of something like that. And so, but that's pretty rare. The activists managed to organize something and I'm going to go there anyway, but in a little bit later this year. So that's the kind of thing. And of course, I think, you know, my Facebook was suddenly shut down for a couple of weeks ago, and it just reappeared with no explanation, of course. And it was kind of just like that. I think the Facebook thing is something that a lot of activists have been.
It's happened to me.
Yeah, it's happened to a lot of activists, and in many cases, when there was an attempt to bring it back, it was brought back. In my case, there was a petition that some friends or people organized, and you know, it came back. So, but I think this is, if anything, it shows desperation because you know they're spending money on hiring people to act as trolls, to act as instigators on Facebook. So I had an altercation with somebody like that, and I exposed them. And a day later, my Facebook was shut down. You know, so I think it's an act of desperation when a state that has got one of the largest armies in the world, a nuclear arsenal, is dealing with this kind of nonsense.
There you have it. You're saying Israel has a nuclear arsenal? Gee, everybody in the world knows this, but have you ever heard Israel admit to having a nuclear arsenal?
Once. Shimon Peres, in an interview, made a, I think it was
a mistake.
A mistake, and he actually admitted that, because he was the guy who was in charge when the nuclear program began. He was the one who pushed for it, and he was the one who was in charge when it began. And in fact, my father was his military advisor at the time. That was the one job my father never talked about, where he was Paris's military advisor during the years when the nuclear program began. But yeah, Israel. But again, they're dealing with this kind of nonsense. They're spending who knows how many millions of dollars on this nonsense. Shutting my Facebook, shutting somebody else's Facebook. It's not going to change anything. There's a reality on the ground. There's a global intifada taking place. There's a tsunami that's coming, and it's going to change every. I really believe there's a public a groundswell of public opinion that's going to change all of this, and sooner than most people think.
So you do carry that optimism, because there is too much pessimism in this world. You cannot effectively accomplish a goal with a defeatist attitude. But everything I hear from you seems to be this positive outlook, this positive attitude. Things are going in the right direction. Things are happening. What do you see? What do you personally see, other than the one thing you just mentioned, that leads you to that level of optimism?
Well, just to make it absolutely clear, I think that things are moving too slow. I think that people are not responding fast enough and not enough in numbers. Somebody said that if Martin Luther King was alive today, he would not have had the support and the Million Man March and all those kinds of things that he had back in the day.
Agreed.
Because people today are apathetic and
complacent and complacent.
Comfortably, I like to use comfortably numb.
we call it the dumbing down of America,
yeah.
And it's quite successful. Like I said, we're talking about the Vietnam War and millions of protesters, one yeah. war. Today, yeah. multiple wars and no protests
yeah.
at all.
So having said that, and I think far too many Palestinians are still going to die, and far too many attacks on Gaza are still going to take place between now and when this optimistic outlook, I think, materializes. But there is a shift. There is a shift around the world. There's a shift in America. There's a shift in Palestine. And I think these shifts, and there's a shift within Israel, too, that it's falling apart. I mean, the corruption in the police force, the military is useless and brutal and corrupt. The government is falling apart. There's really no difference in the different parties. Elections are coming up. I mean, who cares who gets to sit in the big chair, because they're all the same. I mean, there's a reality that is so much stronger than all of this, Israeli PR, or I should say BS. that I think in the next 10 years it's going to be completely different. But again, I think it's too slow. I think it should have happened already. I think people should have responded much stronger to the massacre in Gaza, to all the massacres in Gaza. People need to respond more to the siege on Gaza and so forth. But I do see, I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't absolutely know for certain where this was going, and that there is going to be a positive outcome, or at least that there's a very strong possibility for a positive outcome.
That is very, very good to hear. All right, we're down to our last few minutes. What I would like is to ask Ariana, have you got anything else to inject here, or to ask Miko? Because we've got about 8 minutes, 7 minutes left. So would you like to interject something into the conversation at this point, Ariana?
Well, I think that the positive note to leave it, the note to leave it on is the what Miko just said. It's very inspiring to hear that, especially from someone who's been in the inside of this society and knows the mentality very well, and to hear you say that there is a very strong potential for a positive outcome is very inspiring. So I don't really have anything else to say. I guess I noticed some pictures of you with Hamdi Abu Rama, the photojournalist in the West Bank, and I noticed you were doing some protesting there. And I just wanted to mention that. How was that for you? Because it's a very interesting thing when an Israeli goes into the West Bank and participates in a Palestinian protest.
Well, I'm not the only Israeli that does it, but I do it every time I'm there. I go to Bilayin all the time. I spend the night. I mean, I've got good friends there. And the last time The last time I was protesting there, I actually got arrested, and so it was even more dramatic. And there were pretty dramatic pictures that both Hamdi and several others posted on and Haitham as well posted on Facebook. But I go there all the time. You know, I have a story. There's a really good story. One of the stories in my book about my relationship with Bilayin. The first time I went to Bilayin was in December 2005, just after they began their nonviolent protests. And so I've known these guys and I've been friends with them for a very long time. And you know, the first time I drove there, I thought it was going to be my last day on earth. It was the first time I ever drove alone into the West Bank. And then these beautiful roads that lead to the village, you know, which now I can appreciate as the beautiful roads, were to me filled with Arabs waiting to slice my throat and throw me in the field, you know, to die. So that was very interesting. But I'm there a lot, and like I said, they're all good friends, and I spend the night there, and I protest there, and I support the I don't support. I see myself as part of this resistance as much as I can. So whenever I'm there, either Bilayin or Nabi Saleh or Bit Umar, whatever the case may be. In fact, I have a trial coming up for one of those arrests sometime this year.
Huh. Oh, wow.
Well, I would like to ask you to do a wrap-up for us. I would like to ask you to put out any information, any forums, any websites, any place you feel people can go to become more enlightened as to the situation as it exists in Gaza and Israel today. And take a couple of minutes and, you know, tell the audience anything in a parting shot you feel is germane or pertinent to this topic. And again, I know that's a tough call for about 2 minutes, but whatever you can put out to direct people towards information you feel will help to enlighten them would be greatly appreciated.
Well, I believe in reading books, and so I certainly recommend, I hear that my book, there have been some pretty good reviews about my book, The General Son, so I recommend, certainly happy for people to you can get it on Amazon or you can get it at thegeneralson.com. I recommend strongly that people read and educate themselves. There's quite a few good novels. There's Morning is in Jenin by Susan Abulhawa, which is a massive bestseller, mostly overseas. The Time of White Horses, which is a saga by Ibrahim Nasrallah, who is one of the most important Arab writers today, translated into English, which really demonstrates and really gives you the idea, the understanding of what Palestine is all about. Historical books, you know, Ilan Pappe's Ethnic Cleansing or The Forgotten Palestinians. You know, it's important. There's a wonderful documentary called It's Better to Jump about the city of Akka, which is a city that very few people know about. It's a beautiful Palestinian city right on the coast with a long and interesting history. But this particular documentary is very good. Of course, The Five Broken Cameras about Bilayin and the struggles of the people in Bilayin. I think that it's really, really important for people to support Students for Justice in Palestine and the different student organizations, not to be afraid to support the BDS movement, to make sure that the, you know, shelves on their stores don't carry Israeli products, that they make their voice known, that they understand that this is a struggle that is going to be won, and we can all, when it's over, we'll all be able to be proudly say we stood on the side of justice, we stood on the side of Palestine, whereas the people on the other side are going to either hide in some corner or completely deny that they ever supported Israel. Just like when Mandela became president, suddenly everybody forgot that they called him a terrorist.
And just like at the end of World War II, all of the Germans who swore to God they had nothing to do.
Yeah, there are no Nazis, and of course there are no Nazis in Germany. There are no just like that. There will be no Zionists in America, and very few probably in Israel that admit that they supported this. But I think we all know. In other words, we know who were the people that while the bombs were falling on Gaza were dancing around wrapped in the Israeli flag. I mean, they're on YouTube, so we know exactly who they are. And I think it's important to keep that in perspective. And you want to tell your kids and your grandkids where you stood, because they're going to ask us, and we're going to have to pay and explain ourselves to our children, our grandchildren, about this issue. And this is really the issue that's going to define us, all of us who are alive today.
It is about accountability. And I'm very, very sorry. This is the part of the show, all of these specials I hate the most, but we do have to wrap it up. Ariana, I really, really want to tell you how much I appreciate you bringing Miko as a contact to the Liberty Beacon Project. I'm sure we're going to be doing some more going forward. We will be following you, Miko. We will be reporting on your actions, on your protests. You can send information via Ariana to us at any point in time, and that information will be gotten out on a large global grassroots network. Miko, I also would like to tell you how much I appreciate you being here today. We all see the stories. A lot of us, including myself, write the stories, but it's a narrative we never lived. So to have somebody who grew up in an ingrained society give us your perspective on this. You've opened my eyes in the little time I've been aware of you as to the blight and the plight of the Palestinian people. Both you and Ariana are so much appreciated, and I want to wish you both a very pleasant day. And for everybody listening, this has been another The Liberty Beacon special, brought to you by The Liberty Beacon Project on the Liberty Beacon Radio Network.